Welcome to Living with Dying, a podcast where we're going to talk about the unspeakable, everything to do with death and dying, and how to live with it. We're all on the same journey towards the end, but we just never talk about it. We don't like to think of our own life ending, and we certainly don't like to contemplate losing our nearest and dearest. So we all join in this huge conspiracy, pretending it won't happen to us. And then, when it does, we're often ill-prepared. So we're saying, let's talk about death. Let's open up the subject, and by listening to other people's stories, glean some advice and tips on how best to approach death, how to deal with loss, and how to rebuild a life after. So today I'm back in the hospice talking to Catherine Beer, and we thought it would be a good idea to talk about the language of grief and the language of death and dying, because we're not always blunt about it, are we?
No.
We quite often tiptoe around the subject.
Very much so, very much so. It's a subject that people find almost shameful to talk about and embarrassing. And I think a lot of people often say to me, oh, I can't think about that. Don't want to think about that. If you just talk about it. And almost as if by talking about it, it's going to happen.
So you're talking about before somebody dies,
yeah.
If they come into the hospice.
Yeah.
People don't want to acknowledge that death is on its way.
They don't, but I also think that in everyday life, even when you're just having conversations with your family, I know that when my husband and I wrote our wills, we wanted to run something past both our girls, and they found that very difficult because they didn't want to think about parents dying. And I think it's learning that death and dying is an okay subject to talk about, but actually we need to be very careful about how we do that with the language that we use, because some language, as we'll talk about now, some language is just not helpful.
We use an awful lot of euphemisms, don't we?
We
which
do.
Is to distance ourselves, I suppose.
Yes.
So what are the most common ones of those?
Lots of people find it very difficult to say the word died, dying, dead. They are quite blunt words, aren't they? And there's no sort of flowering, for want of a better phrase. It is what it is. You know, when you say someone has died, you really do understand what you mean. But I think, you know, I've heard phrases, the two common ones are passed away, lost. And I do understand why people use those phrases. They're easier to say. They don't sound so harsh, do they? But actually, it's not really saying it as it is. And I think passed away, what does that mean, passed away? Have they passed somewhat? Does that make sense? It's difficult, isn't it? And lost, they probably do feel lost. When someone dies, they do feel lost, don't they? And you feel lost. But it's important to say that the phrases.
Passed away, I suppose, could be a religious thing originally, could it? As in people pass on to
very
a better
possibly,
life?
Very possibly. And I think that is quite used quite often now, isn't it? Even if it is an old phrase, particularly in faith where within that faith, you feel that someone moves on to a better place. So people will, as you've said, will often say, well, they've passed on to a better place. They've passed on into eternity. They've passed on into heaven. So that, for some people, actually is part of a comforting phrase. But I think we need to tally that up with the real words, bring it into actual reality and help people not to feel frightened of using those words, because they can be quite frightening, can't they?
And going on to Lost now, which you talked about just then, and you talked about the feeling of loss, but it is also to do with having lost the person, isn't it? It's not just, you know, you feel lost, but you have lost something.
Absolutely. You've lost more than that person. You feel you've lost part of you, don't you? You've lost, we could come up with all sorts of areas of life that you feel you've lost when someone dies. You know, when a partner dies, you feel like you've lost your other half, literally. You've lost that person who you sat and did nothing with. You've lost that person to come in from a day out to be able to say, oh, you'll never guess what's just happened. So it is a word that people actually feel quite comforted to say, because it sums it up, doesn't it?
I know I've been guilty of using it, particularly perhaps on the phone when I had to phone up banks or insurance companies or something and say my husband had died. And I think I did feel free enough to say died, but I know I also caught myself saying I lost my husband. And it seems a bit silly looking back, because, I mean, that's an ambiguous phrase, isn't it? It sounds like I lost him at the station or something. Or...
Yes. And that sometimes is what it sounds like. But I think also, as human beings and also British, we are very conscious that when we talk about things that may be a taboo subject like death, we want to make it easier for the other person. But actually, it feels very hard for us, you know, for you, for example, phoning up banks, etc., when Michael died. See, it just trips off the tongue,
yes,
doesn't
it?
But you're, I imagine, trying to make it easy for the other person who's hearing that. And that's why we slip into those phrases.
But the ambiguity, I gather, can be difficult around children.
Very much so. I think with children, it's a very different ball game. And I know here at the hospice, we have an amazing children and families team that support children who has a parent with a life-limiting diagnosis. And it's very, very important with language with children to be very, very precise and very simplistic, but using the words mummy, daddy, granny, grandpa, any relationship is dying, has died, because children really need to know exactly what's what, because as adults we find it very difficult to understand, don't we? And as children it's going to be even harder, so let's not flower things up, let's not complicate it for children, let's be very, very clear, very straight down the line, and otherwise they're going to be frightened and possibly come up with reasons and thoughts that are not accurate.
Yeah, if you say somebody's lost someone, they could assume they've lost them in the park.
Absolutely.
Or lost them at the shops.
So absolutely.
How do you develop that on? How do you explain what death and dying is to a child then in language they understand?
It can be really difficult. There are some amazing resources, some fantastic books that I know the team use. And I know that in my role here, I've stepped in when the team haven't been available and have talked to children about a parent dying. And I do remember one situation where the child was seven, and the parents had asked for support in talking to her. And her mum was young and was dying. And we all sat, me and her parents sat with her around her mum's bed, and we had a conversation and we were very clear. And I think I said something along the lines of, inside mummy's body, there are parts of her body that just are not working properly at the moment and they can't be made better. That medicine has been tried and it hasn't worked. And so one day, parts of mummy's body will stop working and mummy will stop breathing. And that will mean that mummy has died. Because it needed to be very simple, but very accurate. And there was no saying mummy will fall asleep and won't wake up anymore. Because actually that doesn't give the real story. And it would possibly leave her with thinking, well, one day, if daddy was deeply asleep and didn't wake up quickly, has he died? So you need to really alleviate all the confusion for children. And I asked her, did she understand what I meant? And she said, yes. And I said, tell me what you understand. And she talked it back to me. Her mum and dad were very on board with everything that was said. And I said, but, you know, mummy won't hurt. You know, the doctors and nurses are giving her medicine that will help the pain, but doesn't take what's wrong with mummy away. And it was interesting, her mum was very keen to assure her that nothing that was happening was her fault. Because I think children do feel, oh, have I done something wrong? So it's very important as well to help children know that the illness is nothing that anyone has done.
Do you think that kind of conversation, which sounds fantastically useful and helpful, happens enough with small children?
My experience here says I don't think so, because our team is very busy. and we're all often called in to support children alongside our team. And I'm not criticising parents who don't have that conversation with their children. I, as a parent myself, I can't imagine anything more devastating than having to sit down and tell your children that you or your partner are going to die. But I do think that children need to be very, very aware. And I don't think we give children enough credit for what they understand and what they know, because they listen. Even if adults think they're keeping things quiet, children listen and hear words and hear language. And if they're not spoken to directly, they then just come up with conclusions that may or may not be right. And that's, I think, where language needs to be really accurate.
Well, what about a child who's dying? Presumably it's almost more important to have that explained.
Absolutely.
Carefully.
Absolutely.
Accurately.
And I know that here at the hospice, we take people from the age of 16. So 16 to 18 is that in-between stage, isn't it? Where, yes, we have to treat children between the age of 16 and 18 as adults. But there is still a lot of development within their minds and their brains and their bodies that are still going on. And that's a very difficult transitional period. But, you know, we have cared for young people. I think that's a much nicer description, children. We have cared for a few young people between the ages of 16 and 18 here at the hospice. And all of those young people have wanted, absolutely, straight down the line, straight talking, accurate words, correct descriptions, and to be fully involved in their care and their treatment and their decisions. And that's quite an incredible thing to be part of, to be caring for young people at that age. But they need accurate language.
And do you find they then use that same language back to you? Do they talk about dying?
They do. They do. Yeah, and that's very powerful. Very powerful.
Must be heartbreaking.
It is a very different way of caring. And I know that we've had a lot of support here at the hospice in guidance for us. It's a completely different way. They're all individuals, all our patients, obviously, and each patient needs their own level of care. But a young person, you know, there is a lot of other aspects of that. They may have younger siblings, you know, younger people who are cared for here may have parents who are quite young as well. And so it's very different way of caring, a different way of supporting, but equally as important, as vital to get it right.
I can't help wondering if that category that you're talking about would be the most likely not to want to use the correct language, because it must be such a shattering thing to try and incorporate within a family. It's kind of easier, isn't it, to not talk about dying and death.
It's so much easier, because if we don't talk about it, we can pretend it's not happening, can't we? And I think that goes across the board. I think whatever the age, whatever the family setup, if you don't talk about it, and particularly if you don't talk about it in the correct terms, it can just not happen. And I think that's where the awareness, definitely through this podcast, but through education and the awareness of death and dying, needs to be so prominent for us all. But equally, you know, as your podcast series is titled Living with Dying, it's really important, because just because someone is dying doesn't mean to say they're not living. They're still living until the end, aren't they? And I think that's where the language is really important.
So with all your experience, what would you say to other people who know a family where something like this is happening, one of them is dying? What's the best language for us to use to help other people, to support other people, not to upset them, not to say the wrong thing?
It's really interesting, isn't it? Because we are all very keen not to say the wrong thing. And actually, sometimes when we don't know what to say, I think it's okay to acknowledge that and to say to somebody, I'm really sorry, I don't know if I have got any words for you, but I'm here. I'm beside you. Because sometimes there aren't any words that is going to make it better, is there? And you and I have both been through situations where loved ones have died. And I think someone saying to me, I just don't know what to say, but I'm sorry, that for me was as important as someone suddenly having a gem of a sentence to say to me. I think it's some of the phrases that come to mind are acknowledging how difficult it is. It must be really tough for you right now. It's not asking how are you doing, because I mean, you know, that could get quite a drastic answer back if someone's feeling really raw and just not knowing how they feel. Just by saying it must be really tough for you right now, give some permission to say, yeah, it is. It's really tough. Maybe don't ask, please let me know if there's anything I can do. You might have had experience of that, because actually you don't maybe know what there is that you want them to do, because decisions are really hard when you're grieving. Sometimes you don't actually know what you're going to eat, let alone what can someone do to help. So maybe just saying to somebody, I'm going to come over tomorrow and I'm going to bring you a dinner, because you're practically helping and you're not asking for a decision. I'm going to pop over and I'm going to do your laundry. You know, just things that are essentials of daily life, but actually when you're grieving, those essentials fall by the wayside, because sometimes it's all you can do to get yourself up out of bed and dressed, isn't it?
That's really interesting. And I've read recently of somebody who said he was brought round a box of tea bags, a giant box of tea bags, which wouldn't have occurred to me as being particularly useful, but I guess in certain families who would expect lots and lots of visitors, that would be very helpful.
Absolutely.
I've sometimes said take around a casserole, yeah, rather similar to what you've said, but then I've heard other people say they wouldn't want that because they're not eating or because they haven't got an appetite. So it's really hard to try and work out what each particular individual might appreciate.
It's really hard. And I do get that about the meals. I wonder whether taking a meal round in a freezable container, because they don't have to eat it straight away, pop it in the freezer, and there might be a day coming up where they think, oh, what am I going to eat today? Oh, I've got that casserole or that shepherd's pie. Or so you're not sort of giving them something that if they then feel they can't eat or don't want to eat, they then feel bad because they're not eating it straight away. They can pop it into their freezer, then it's there, isn't it? I always think about, you know, when someone dies, I don't know about you, Dillis, but one of my instant reactions is, I send them some flowers, which is lovely and beautiful. And I think sending flowers to someone is an incredibly beautiful gesture. But I was thinking about that recently. A friend of mine, her husband died at the end of November. And I thought, I bet her house is going to be like a florist. What else can I do? So, I mean, the internet's an amazing thing, isn't it? There's so many things like letterbox gifts. You don't even have to answer the door to the postman. And so I sent a letterbox gift because, as the name would suggest, it went through the letterbox. And I think it had like a pair of fluffy socks and a sachet of hot chocolate and a bar of chocolate, all of those sorts of things that just, I didn't know what else to do. And, you know, I still sometimes don't know what to do or say, even though I've got years of experience here. And so just something, a little gesture like that, I think can go a long way.
That sounds like a great idea, because mm-hmm. you don't want to have to open the door necessarily when you've just been bereaved. Mm-hmm. If you don't know who's on the other side of that door, you don't know if you're going to have to put on a front and be nice to someone you don't particularly want to see. It's a minefield. Mm-hmm. So yes, things that just come through a letterbox. Yeah. I go with that.
Yeah, they are, and there are some amazing things out there. You know, and so sort of thinking about different phrases. This all happens eventually. That's probably not very helpful.
No,
I don't think. I think that's probably quite hurtful. So maybe just turning that and again acknowledging you must really miss them. And then that gives that person permission to say, do you know what? Yes, I miss them so much, it hurts. It's a physical hurt. And it's just about, isn't it, thinking about acknowledging how they must be feeling or might be feeling. And allowing them to expand on that. But I think also asking them, tell me about, in the name of, you know, tell me about Michael, or, you know, people would say to me, tell me about your dad. And I, you know, my family will tell you that's one of my pet subjects, because the person, it still exists in our hearts and our memories, don't they? And talking about them keeps them alive and validates their presence.
But there is that kind of feeling in the air, isn't there, that people don't want to mention the name of your lost loved one, because they think that's going to upset you all over again. But as one of, I think it might have been Tom who I spoke to earlier in this podcast, as he said, things can't get any worse at that point. They are at their worst.
Yes.
So you can't be even more upset.
No.
And you probably do very much want to talk about that person.
Absolutely. And in the First Steps bereavement group that we run here at the hospice, that I think I mentioned in our previous podcast, one of the things we talk about with people is allowing yourself to wallow with a purpose. Allow yourself to be in your emotions, allow yourself to cry, and to cry when you talk about that person, because the purpose of that is to express your emotions, to move in your grief, to be moved in your grief, Because grief is about emotion, isn't it? Grief is about being moved. And, you know, someone said, and it's an oft-quoted phrase, grief is the price we pay for love. And a relationship that is no longer there in physicality, still there very much in our hearts. And so it's okay to ask somebody to talk about their loved one. You'll probably find they want to.
And as you've mentioned the word heart, I did want to talk about how relevant some of the phrases and sayings that we use are, because, you know, you hear these phrases, heart sink, downhearted, heavy-hearted, all that kind of thing. And I can remember, yes, dwelling in the moment, wallowing, as you might say, when I was really downhearted and feeling that actual sinking. It literally feels like your heart is sinking down, down through your body, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And then I could relate to heavy-hearted too, same sort of thing. I suppose it's heavy and it's pushing down. There are so many phrases around heart, and some of them are good and some of them are bad, like heart-to-heart discussion is wonderful,
yes,
isn't it?
Yes.
And loving someone with all my heart is great. But yes, I think it's interesting that they're based in reality, obviously. Some authors in the past, probably Shakespeare more than most, have identified that heart sinking down, a very real thing.
Absolutely. And heartbroken is one I hear so often. And it's so descriptive, particularly for somebody whose partner has died. But heartbroken is applicable to anybody who's experienced the death of a loved one. Friendships, you know, I've had, you know, deaths of friends over the years who have been incredibly impactful in my life when they were alive. And yeah, that there are times when I would say I'm heartbroken over that death, because it's part of you. Friendship, relationship, partnership, it's part of you, isn't it? And I think it's interesting, as you say, that a lot of the phrases around describing how you feel is linked to the heart.
And I wonder whether it's helpful to think about that in an individual case, because I would say that probably right now I've gone from being downhearted to much more lighthearted. Not totally lighthearted, but, you know, I can actually almost see it like a graph. I'm working towards the lighthearted bit, I suppose.
Yeah.
And that can sometimes be helpful, can't it?
Absolutely.
Just chart your progress in that kind of way.
Yeah.
I also thought a lot about words to do with death and dying, which again we use a lot in everyday speech, don't we? Like dead end and deadline, dead cert. At death's door is a funny one. I suppose that's supposed to be to do with knocking on death's door.
Possibly, but it's a very odd phrase.
Yes. Mm. Dead to the world.
That's one we hear quite a lot, isn't it? And those phrases here in the hospice take on a completely different meaning, because those phrases are said just matter-of-factly, aren't they? With no one thinking about.
Yeah, it's like dying to do something. Mm. I'm dying to go on holiday. I mean, why would we say that?
Mm. And I think that when you have experienced the death of a loved one, when you hear those phrases, they hit really hard, because you actually realise the impact of those words, and those words are actually quite significant. And why are we using that phrase? Yes, you're right, dying to go on holiday. I mean, that's just random, isn't it? And why did they start being acceptable?
And they are in everyday currency. They're
absolutely
all around us, aren't they?
Yeah.
Can I tell you two phrases that I loathe?
Yes, please do.
One is sorry for your loss, because it's said so glibly by people, and it tends to be said by people who don't know you well at all. Maybe somebody on the phone that you've just announced a death to, and it's so quick, it comes out so quickly, and you think it's not really sincere.
I think it's one that people feel they need to say, they should say, you know. And again, it comes back to that very British, for want of a better phrase, that British sort of not wanting to know, not wanting to say, not wanting to acknowledge really what's happened and not knowing what to say. So we say what we think we should. And it's that awkwardness. And what does it mean? I'm sorry for your loss.
What would be a better way of saying it? Let's say for someone in a professional position, say someone at the end of the phone on the gas board, say, who has been trained up maybe to say sorry for your loss, and it annoys the bereaved person greatly. What would be a better way of phrasing that?
It's an interesting question. I know that when I make follow-up calls here at the hospice, which is what we do, a few days following the death of somebody, we'll always phone the person who's been bereaved and just check in and see how those first few days have been feeling for them. I say phoning following the death of Fred, let's say, how have the past few days been? If I hadn't met them here and I was just making the call, I would say, I'm sorry to hear Fred has died, and I just want to check in and see how today is feeling for you. That's a long answer, and maybe someone on the other end of the gas board may not say all of that. I'm thinking that actually just to say, I'm sorry to hear that.
Or I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yes,
I think that would have satisfied me.
I think so, because I'm sorry is actually quite an odd phrase, isn't it? Because it sounds like you're apologising for something that you've done. You haven't. But you are sorry. You are feeling sorrow that that person has experienced the death of somebody. I'm sorry to hear that.
I'd advocate that. The other thing I hate, and I suppose it happens particularly when somebody dies at a certain age, is the phrase, he or she had a good innings.
It should, yes. That should be a banned phrase, because it doesn't really matter how many years that person had had. That person has died. And at whatever age it is, it's incredibly, incredibly sad, because there are going to be people who are grieving at whatever age that person was. It doesn't matter how many years they had.
And it would be fairly simple, I think, to phrase it differently and make it sound more acceptable, like, what a wonderful life he or she led. How wonderful they achieved so much, or things like that. But having a good innings, like a cricket match. It's not like a cricket match.
It's not. And it's, you know, it's a bit like, you know, when, earlier on when I mentioned the phrase that some people will say is, oh, they're in a better place. Well, actually, I don't really care about that, is my view, is because I want them here. So please don't say to me, oh, they're in a better place. Actually, it's about acknowledging that that person who has been bereaved is suffering. I'm sorry you're suffering. I'm sorry you're hurting.
Does this depend a bit on the faith of the person, the family? Because there are people who believe you die and go to heaven. Mm-hmm. So perhaps it's acceptable to say that to them, is it?
And this might be controversial, but I don't think it's acceptable to say that to anybody, because even if the death has happened within a family where there is a faith and a belief that that person is in heaven, eternity, whatever the phrase is that they would use, I would imagine that person, being human, is still going to wish that that person was still there with them here. And being human with a faith is really hard, I think, for some people, because you feel that you can't grieve properly because you do believe they've gone to a better place. But from a human point of view, you're still hurting. You're still suffering. And you still want that person with you.
And another phrase we didn't use earlier, but is quite a common one, and I'd be interested to hear what you think of this one, is slipped away.
Yes, an interesting one. Slipped away. Have they slipped away? Slipped? No. People do say that because they, again, they don't quite know how else to phrase it. And actually, processing this out loud, people who have witnessed someone dying may well feel that that does describe what they saw.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah, because I know it's not everyone's experience of watching someone die, but quite often it is very peaceful. It can be very peaceful. And it can be watching the breathing getting slower and slower and with gaps until eventually it stops. And so for somebody watching that, they might feel they have just slipped away. They've gone. And so maybe for someone that is an accurate description, and give some comfort, maybe.
I have a kind of feeling, and I may be wrong, that that was said in the announcement about the Queen's death.
I think you might be right. Slipped away peacefully. And, I mean, I think, well, obviously, we'll never fully know, will we? But that is potentially what the family saw. Just peacefully breathing, slowing, calmly, calmly, until it stops.
So we seem to be saying that is a phrase that is more acceptable than the others, like passed on and passed
away. Yeah, I think if someone uses that phrase, slipped away, that is probably because they feel that's what they saw happen.
And at rest is another one that crops up, isn't it? And I guess that's similar.
At rest, at peace. Those two phrases actually are very important for people who have watched someone go through suffering and pain and a struggle with their illness, maybe. I hear it quite often here, particularly if a patient has had trouble with pain and has quite a long-standing pain issue, and when that's got on top of here and things become calmer and more peaceful, actually it's very important for someone to be able to say they're at peace now, because that's literally what they see, and that's quite comforting. In fact, it's very comforting, I think, for people,
particularly after pain.
Yeah, very much so.
To end on a slightly cruder note then,
yes.
There are another couple of phrases which I wanted to bring up. Croaked.
I haven't heard that one here, but an interesting one.
I think we can understand where that comes from,
yes.
Can't we? Because there was always this story about the death rattle.
Yes.
I'm not sure how based in fact that is, but that would explain croaked.
It would. And actually, you know, sometimes the breathing of somebody as they are approaching their last days, sometimes into hours, their breathing can be very noisy and it can be rattly. And I think that phrase, the death rattle, is born out of literally what you hear. It doesn't happen all the time, but yes, croaked must come from that. Very unusual. I haven't actually heard that here.
Perhaps some of these are passing out of common usage, and
maybe
that wouldn't be a bad thing. But snuffed it is the other one I noted down.
Yeah. I find that quite a sad phrase. actually. Because I think when I hear the word snuffed, I think of I don't know what the actual phrase is, a snuffer, where you can, you know, with a candle, you don't have to blow it out, you can put it out, can't you? There will be an official phrase that I don't know. But that's what I always think of when I hear that, oh, they've snuffed it. You think, oh, gosh. So I can see where it comes from, because when you put a candle out, the light goes out. When someone dies, you feel the light from them has gone out. But yes, it's not a very kind phrase, I don't think. People might find it helpful to say, I don't know.
I certainly would acknowledge that I've used the phrase pop my clogs or pop your clogs, when you pop your clogs, because it seems a much more light-hearted way of introducing the subject of death and dying. Mm-hmm. When you're not encountering death or dying, so in normal life, but I have no idea where that comes, popping my clogs, have you?
I've got no idea where that comes from, and I think you're right. I think it's used because people feel, well, we're not actually saying the D word. We're not, you know, we're not going to talk it up, but we do need to sort of refer to it. So it maybe it's got some sort of loose grounding in sort of slang or taking the mickey out of something. I don't know. It'd be interesting to look that up, wouldn't it?
Well, we've covered a lot of different phrases and sayings, but basically the message from you is be direct.
Be direct.
Tell it as it is.
You can be direct and be very loving at the same time and very caring and very supportive and acknowledge what's going on.
And when it comes to helping other people, we've talked about the kinds of things you can say and do to them. And you talked about practical things being helpful. Mm. Actually, I don't think I'm going to say that. No, I'm going to stop this one here. Thank you. I'm going to say thank you properly, though.
Okay.
That's all very interesting and useful. Catherine Beer, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you.
We'll be having more chats in future episodes about everything to do with death and dying, such as how to prepare for it, what it's really like when someone dies, how to talk about it, what kind of plans to make, how different cultures and faiths approach dying and bereavement, lots more around grief and loss, how to support others in their sadness, and my personal hobby horse, how to rebuild a life, a good life, after the loss of someone special. If you'd like to join us to talk about the death of someone near to you, if this episode has resonated with you and you have a story to share, or if you've been affected by some of the issues raised, please do get in touch at hello@livingwithdying.co.uk.